शयराधमार हवा कुंचा बिहा हरे शयराधमार हवा कुंचा बिहा हरे चन्न पग्रवरधारे कपि चन्न पग्रवरधारे यशोरनन्दन व्रजजन रञ्जन यशोरनन्दन व्रजजन रञ्जन यमुन तीरावन हरे यमुन तीरावन हरे
Vishnupad Paramahamsa Radhika Chara Sotera Siddhi Sri Srinivasa Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Samaveda Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai Gaura Premananda All glories to Simha devotees All glories to Simha devotees All glories to Simha devotees All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya I'm very happy to be here today. I mean that literally because I'm leaving tomorrow. I was just in Mayapur in India, very, very wonderful there. Although I was mostly there on GBC business and meetings, I was quite surprised. I thought in May, where it's about 102, 103 degrees every day, literally, and I thought it'd be just very completely dead, like nobody there. But it was very, very much alive and thriving. Hundreds, thousands of devotees there leading up to Lord Nrisimhadev's appearance day. It's a very, very big festival, of course, with Lord Nrisimhadev in Mayapur. And I think that Mangal Arti Kalona Shingadev's appearance day, which is, I had to leave that later that day, there were probably 5,000 devotees in the temple. And not so much foreign devotees, but, you know, from all over India, people were coming. And also, just to mention, the Temple of Vedic Planetarium is continuing to grow. I was there in February, and it seems like, you know, a whole other wing sprouted up, and, you know, a few more stories. It's just growing amazingly fast. It's probably about 10 stories high now. You know, the outer structure, of course, there'll be so much work to do. And but the anticipation opening, at least for the deity installation, is 4 years, 2016. So something we can all look forward to. Anyway, as I said, I'm leaving for New Vrindavan tomorrow in the Vessel of Inspiration. I think many people from here will be going. We'll see you there. So we are reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 8, Text 22. Is that right? Let's see, I think this is the Govindam tune. Tavangri Yugman Anukrishya Sarishapanto. Gosha Pragosha Ruchiram Rajakardameshu. Tanara Hrishta Manasavana Shrityalokam. Magda praditva rupeya turanti antimatro. Tavangri yugman anu krishna sari shripantau. Gosha pragosha ruchiram rajakardameshu. Tannada Hrishta Manasavana Shritya Lokam Magda Pradita Varupeya Turanti Matro Tavangri Yugma Manukrishya Sarisha Pantau Gosha Pragosha Ruchiram Rajakardameshu Tannada Hrishta Manasavana Shritya Lokam Magda Pradita Varupeya Turanti Matro Others? Dragging their legs. Sarishra Pantau. Crawling like snakes. Gosha Pragosha Ruchiram. Producing a sound with their ankle bells. That was very, very sweet to hear. Rajakardameshu. In the mud created by the cow dung and cow urine on the earth of Rajabhumi. Tatnada, by the sound of those ankle bells.
Krishna Manasau.
Being very much pleased. Anushritya. Following. Lokam. Other persons. Mugdha. Thus being enchanted. Prabhitavat. Then again being afraid of them. Upayatu. Immediately returned. Antimatro. Toward their mothers. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. When Krishna and Balaram, with the strength of their legs, crawled in the muddy places created in Raja by cow dung and cow urine, their crawling resembled the crawling of serpents, and the sounds of their ankle bells were very charming. Very much pleased by the sound of other people's ankle bells, they used to follow these people as if going to their mothers. But when they saw that these were other people, they became afraid and returned to the real mothers, Yashoda and Rohini. Purport. When Krishna and Balaram were crawling around Rajabhumi, they were enchanted by the sound of ankle bells. Thus they sometimes followed other people who would enjoy the crawling of Krishna and Balaram and exclaim, "Oh, see how Krishna and Balaram are crawling." Upon hearing this, Krishna and Balaram could understand that these were not their mothers they were following, and they would return to their actual mothers. Thus, the crawling of Krishna Balaram was enjoyed by the people of the neighborhood, as well as by Mother Yashoda and Rohini, and the two children themselves. Om Jnana Timaram Disha Jnanjana Salakaya Chakshurumi Tamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpa Trivishcha Kripasindivivicha Patitano Pavanivyo Vaishnavivyo Namaha Jai Haribol. So we're continuing these very wonderful childhood pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan. This particular one, I found it so interesting. You'll have to forgive my little diversion here as a former professor of developmental psychology. It's kind of interesting that Krishna and Balaram here are acting as ordinary children, and they follow other mothers around, but they hear their ankle bells, but once they see them, they become afraid, because this isn't really their mother, and they run back to their mothers. Now, all of you who are parents, and I think several of you mothers can relate to this, that there's a certain age that this always happens with children. Babies, of course, well, anybody can pick them up and they're perfectly happy and they don't make a lot of distinction. But once they reach a certain age, and we say usually between about 8 and 14 months, we have these psychological phenomena called stranger anxiety and separation anxiety that come about, which means that the child no longer will just accept anyone, but becomes a little bit very wary of other strangers and very much feels the separation when they're away from their parents. Now, fortunately, this, you know, lasts a few months and then it tends to go away. And anyway, we won't get into a psychology class here today, but it's very interesting that Krishna and Balaram show these same symptoms. And they're beginning to crawl here, which would be about, what would that be? About that age, right? That's about 8 months old, maybe. So it's interesting how this how they display these very human-like qualities as babies. And of course, when they do this, it's very delightful to the elderly gopis. Interesting when we say elderly gopis. These elderly gopis are probably, what, 25, 30 years old, you know, and the young mothers, really. But you know, as distinguished from, like, the gopis in the Rasa dance, who are all of, what, about 14? You know, so, you know, the ages are all a little bit relative here in Vrindavan, but we can understand that the Krishna and Balaram are starting to manifest these different pastimes as they go through their different stages of growth. And in each one of us, just like we enjoy and relish as we see young children and babies growing and developing in, you know, the next stage, then they're crawling, then they're walking, etc. So these pastimes are much more enjoyed by Mother Yashoda, Mother Rohini, and the other older gopis. So, if we hear these pastimes, someone who is not a devotee could easily misinterpret what is happening here. And there's two common misinterpretations or mistakes that we might see. One, we might assume that Krishna is just acting like a human being. In other words, God is whatever God is, and he comes to this material world, he incarnates into this material world, and he's more or less acting like he's a human being, so he's performing these different activities. Another different interpretation might be that, well, actually, this is probably just some kind of Indian mythology, and what people are doing is they're projecting our own human nature on God. Now, this is called anthropomorphism, when we project our human qualities onto something else. People do this often with their pets. You ever notice that? You know, people are convinced that their pets just have this entire huge range of subtle emotions, you know, and understand their very thoughts. And anyway, animals do understand a little bit. They have consciousness, you know, let's give them a little credit, but they probably do not have such human qualities as often are attributed to them. On the other hand, we have what we're talking about now is really what's technically called anthropotheism, that people will project their ideas from the human perspective on what God must be. So this is something that in philosophy that they talk about, anthropotheism. But there's another sort of opposite term called theomorphism, which means that humans have some divine-like qualities because of the qualities that are there in the absolute, in God. And that's actually closer to the truth. In the even in the Christian religion, they say that man is made in the image of God. So this is actually how it is. We have qualities, we have features, we have form, because God has those forms, God has those features and qualities. So we know that it's not that, you know, we're creating some assumption of God based upon our own relative vision. Rather, Krishna is the origin of all. He is what everything is coming from, you know, and so therefore, anything that we see in this material world is simply a reflection of his qualities and his variegated energies. So we can understand that when Krishna comes, he's not just playing like a child, or we're not projecting our images of a human child onto him. Rather, he is coming in his own spiritual transcendental form. Bhagavad Gita says, Ajopi san avyatma bhutana mishvaropi san prakritim swam adishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. Although I'm unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I'm the Lord of all living entities, I still appear in every millennium in my own transcendental form. 4:6, Bhagavad Gita. So this transcendental form that Krishna talks about in Bhagavad Gita indicates an eternal spiritual form. So even when he comes into this material world, when he manifests himself every millennium, he still comes in that original spiritual transcendental form, which is non-different than that form in Goloka Vrindavan. So as Krishna's forms is eternal, so his relationships are all eternal and fully spiritual. So the pastimes that we're hearing that Krishna enacted 5,000 years ago in Gokula Vrindavan are non-different than those pastimes that are being enacted eternally in the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan. So we can understand that there's really no difference whatsoever. So we're seeing those eternal pastimes. Actually, we're very, very privileged. It's really rather amazing when you think about that, from having access by Srila Prabhupada's mercy to the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're getting this glimpse into what actually God does eternally. What is his relationship with his devotees that is going on in the spiritual world? So this is a very, very amazing and remarkable thing if we actually reflect upon, you know, the great mercy that we have to really be able to understand who is God, what does he look like, what is he doing, what is his relationship. So in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we see the enactment of so many of these relationships. And we can understand that Krishna enjoys these rasas, five primary rasas, and there's the secondary rasas. But the five primary rasas of neutral, servitude, friendship, conjugal love, and parental rasas are being enacted. And we see from the Srimad Bhagavatam that all of these are displayed in full, particularly, of course, the higher four. So I also found that it's interesting that the very first verse of Bhaktivedanta Sindhu of the Nectar Devotion, in fact, the very first line of the book, which is, of course, begins with the glorification of Krishna, the very first line is Akhila Rasamrita Murti, which Prabhupada translates from the Chaitanya Charitamrita when he mentioned, that verse is mentioned, it's spoken by Lord Chaitanya, and Srila Prabhupada translates Akhila Rasamrita Murti as the reservoir of all pleasure in which exist all the mellows of devotional service, namely Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsala, and Madhurya. So this is really the basis of devotional service. This is the first thing that's mentioned in Nectar Devotion, that Krishna is the basis of these five rasas. And so our understanding of devotional service is primarily to understand our relationship with Krishna. And of course, much of that is not only understanding the relationship with Krishna, but what we must do to realize and understand that relationship again, and that is the whole process of sadhana bhakti. So, of course, this verse, particularly in this section of Srimad Bhagavatam, and you could say that a lot of the beginning chapters of the Bhagavatam are really concentrating on Vatsalya Rasa, because we're seeing Krishna as a child, Krishna as a baby, and then as a young boy. And so, of course, most of those relationships will center around his relationship with parents. Just as we see young babies and children, their primary attachment relationship is with parents. Then as they get older, they form relationships with other friends, and we see Krishna will. Then his pastimes will tend to shift more to the coward boys and that Sakya Rasa. And then, of course, we know as boys and girls get older, reach adolescence, their interest in relationship turns just as Krishna's does to the conjugal relationship, where Krishna then relates to the gopis, and then of course later to the queens in Dwarka. So at any rate, now we are kind of looking at this Vatsalya Rasa, and it's very, very beautiful, very, very sweet in so many ways. We always relish every year during the month of Kartik, the Dhammadrastakam, with such a beautiful rendition, you know, of the sweetness and the beauty of Krishna's childhood pastimes, and particularly his pastime with Mother Yashoda and that whole pastime of the binding of Krishna with the ropes. So these are things that are very much relishable by the devotees. So we should also understand that, as I was saying in the beginning, philosophically we understand that Krishna is the origin of everything, and everything more or less emanates from him, and everything we see, even in this material world, is a reflection of the spiritual reality. So Krishna's relationships are the basis of our human relationships and human interaction. In other words, we have experienced the same type of, not the same time, but similar relationships with Krishna simply because they come from Krishna. And therefore, they are spiritual and complete, and everything in this material world can be considered that reflection of the spiritual world. Now, in many places in our scriptures and Srila Prabhupada's purports, he calls it a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. Now, what is that word? The word seems a little strong, perverted. But what it means is it's imperfect. What we see in this material world is a reflection of the spiritual, but it has, Prabhupada would say, inebriety, or it has imperfections. It is not perfect and complete like those relationships, the variety, and the form that we see in the spiritual world. There's a nice explanation of this from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adilila 156. This is from Srila Prabhupada's purport. He said, "One should understand, through the transparent medium of the spiritual master, that the Supreme Lord exists everywhere in his transcendental spiritual nature, and the living entity's relationship with the Lord are directly and indirectly existing everywhere, even in this material world. In the spiritual world, there are five kinds of relationships with the Supreme Lord: Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsala, and Madhurya. The perverted reflections of these rasas are found in the material world. Land, home, and furniture, and other inert material objects are related in Shanta, or in neutral and silent sense, whereas servants work in the Dasya relationship. The reciprocation between friends is called Sakya, and the affection of a parent for a child is known as Vatsalya. And the affairs of conjugal love constitute Madhurya." So Srila Prabhupada is saying that these same relationships can be seen. We have examples of those even in the material world. These five relationships in the material world are distorted reflections of the original pure sentiments, which should be understood and perfected in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master. In the material world, the perverted rasas bring frustration. If these rasas are established, re-established with Lord Krishna, the result is eternal, blissful life. So, of course, this is a very simple description of the difficulty with these relationships in the material world. They bring frustration. And we can elaborate that for probably many classes about how frustrating things are within this material world. And all of us have probably experienced frustration in our different relationships with other people in this material world. Those relationships, of course, are filled with so many difficulties, so many problems, because we all really want that perfect relationship, don't we? We all want our spouse to be Radha or Krishna. You know, we want our children to be like Krishan Balaram, you know, plain, you know, so blissful and cute in Vrindavan. This is what we really want, you know. And so we try to find it in this material world. We try to find it in our relationships with human beings. And, of course, we're always frustrated because they're never perfect. They're never complete. People always let us down to some degree. And, of course, it's described that... Who used the word? Was it Yudhishthira who used the term fallible soldiers? I think it was Yudhishthira. But anyway, we hear this that these relationships, our kinsmen, that's kind of not a word we use so much. These in the scriptures, you know, our relatives, they're all called fallible soldiers. Because even if they can give us some happiness, ultimately the time of death, we're all separated. So these relationships can never be eternal. Even if they give us some happiness, and even if they can remain fairly good for some period of time, they will not last forever. And therefore, they're ultimately fallible, because we are separated at the time of death. Now, the other problem with our relationships in the material world is that there is almost always a degree of selfishness, a degree of personal desire. That's natural. It's going to be there because we have material desires in this material world. We look for other people to fulfill those desires. That's natural. And in fact, in a good relationship, we often say that there's a mutual satisfaction of desires. That's in a good relationship. So, I mean, in a poor relationship, there's usually inequality or there's no satisfaction or one person is taking advantage of another. But even in a very good relationship, we often define that as one where there's mutuality. Or where both people, say, in a relationship, the partners are equally giving to one another. But when you think about it, even that reflects a degree of being very self-centered. You know, in other words, I am giving as much, you know, to my partner because I know that that person is also giving to me, that there's reciprocation. Now, what we see, of course, in Vrindavan is very different. We don't see this kind of bargaining about reciprocation. It's very, very selfless. The residents of Vrindavan are simply in love with Krishna. They're simply giving to Krishna. They're simply serving Krishna with their entire heart, with everything that they have. And we don't see this so much in the material world. Now, Prabhupada did say that the closest that we see is the relationship of a mother to their child. That's actually the closest to a spiritual relationship. Now, why is that? Because the mother is acting very, very selflessly. Fathers too, you know. But in other words, they don't expect a lot for themselves. And you don't get a whole lot, at least for many years either. You know, it's a very selfless type of relationship where, you know, you're more or less giving to that person. Now, that may be satisfying, it may be frustrating, it may be many things, but when we have that same relationship with Krishna, and we're simply giving to Krishna a relationship, Prabhupada says the result is eternal, blissful life. One is fully satisfied because that is our nature. Our sarup, our sanatana dharma, our nature is to be in relationship, loving relationship, in service to Krishna. So therefore, when we reestablish that relationship with Krishna, then we are completely satisfied. Because it is who we are, it is what we are meant to do. So, everything we experience in this material world is there in the spiritual world, including these relationships. The Bhagavad Gita 15.1 describes this material world as a banyan tree, with its roots upward and its branches going downward. And Prabhupada says the purport, we've never seen such a tree, but if you look at a reflection in the water of a tree, you see that. In other words, everything is backwards. What's up is down. So that example is given in the same way that in this material world, often what is considered very desirable is actually not so much, and what may seem, you know, very difficult is actually sometimes very, very good. Just like Prabhupada would say that devotional service, sometimes we make, not always, but sometimes we may experience it as poison in the beginning, but it's nectar in the end. Why is it poison in the beginning? Because we may have to give up things we don't want to give up, like the four regular principles. So that might be, for the living entity, poisonous in the beginning to have to give up those certain material activities. But in the end, it is nectar. So devotional service is a process of re-establishing or transferring all those attachments that we have in this material world to the spiritual. That's really what we're doing. We start with all of these material attachments and we're spiritualizing them. We're shifting that center to Krishna. Next verse in the Bhagavad Gita, the same purport, describes this 7:19. After many births and deaths, he who is actually knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. Purport. When one is further advanced, he can understand that these activities in spiritual life and that these activities constitute devotional service. Realizing this, he becomes attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrenders to him. At such a time, one can understand that Lord Sri Krishna's mercy is everything, and that he is the cause of all causes, and this material manifestation is not independent from him. He realizes the material world to be a perverted reflection of spiritual variegatedness, and he realizes that in everything there is a relationship with the Supreme Lord Krishna. Thus, he thinks of everything in relationship to Vasudev or Sri Krishna. Such a universal vision of Vasudev precipitates one's full surrender to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna as the highest goal. Such surrendered great souls are very rare. Yes, so we can understand somewhat about the rarity of pure devotional service. Because the pure devotee sees everything in relationship with Krishna. So that's what's really being described here, how we shift that consciousness, how we shift that vision from the material to the spiritual. And of course, that's what Krishna consciousness is. It's real simple, being conscious of Krishna. So the more to the degree that we're conscious of Krishna, the more that we see everything in relationship to Krishna, the more that we spiritually advance. So a relative advancement has to do with how much we keep our material life separate. In other words, I should say our lack of spiritual advancement means that we sort of keep the material activities, the material consciousness, material relationships as separate from Krishna. So in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, this is the case. All of our activities are not yet fully in alignment with Krishna. I mean, this is to be expected. It's not something to lament or beat ourselves up about. This is the reality. We've been in this material world for countless lifetimes. We're very attached to things in the material world. Everything that we seem to know, at least our material intelligence and mind, is absorbed in materialism. Therefore, coming to Krishna consciousness is going to take some time for the consciousness to become purified, for the mirror of the heart to become cleansed of all the anartas, of all the past attachments, and for us to gradually shift this consciousness to seeing everything in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in the beginning, our devotional service is mixed. We have karma mishra bhakti. Bhakti, it is bhakti. It is devotional service because it's under the instruction and the order of the pure spiritual master. But it's mixed. We still have some material attachment in the beginning. Or jnana mishra bhakti, some attachment to mental speculation. I was thinking about this sort of connection between the spiritual and material, somehow this thought came back from about seventh grade, which is probably, 70, 80 years ago for me? Not quite. But it seemed like a long time ago. And I respect, was anyone during that sort of new math period? Anyway, one thing that, I remember that he taught us a thing about Venn diagrams and set theory. Does anyone remember that? Do they teach that anymore? I don't think they do. I don't think they do. I don't know if it's out of fashion now or not. But in fact, I don't even know exactly how it's even useful. but I somehow remember this picture. These Venn diagrams were circles, and the circles had overlap. And they talked about the union of the two sets and the whatever. Different things about set theory. So I was thinking it's a good, interesting way of conceiving the circular representation of the sets of our of pure devotional service would be one set, and then our duties and activities and relationships in the material world would be this other set. So you got these two circles that are here. So for a non-devotee, those two circles are completely separate. If they're, in fact, this devotional service circle would be tiny or non-existent almost, and everything is one's material activities. And then as we begin the process of devotional service, in the beginning, the devotional service circle is growing, and there's some overlap. In other words, there's a certain amount of one's life that one is dedicating to Krishna. Maybe one comes to the temple at some period of time and remembers Krishna, does some service for Krishna, hears and chants a little bit, and then kind of goes back to their normal life. their material life. Now, as one begins advanced, and one becomes more dedicated and committed and actually understands the principle of Krishna consciousness, which we could also see as like moving from the Kanishtha to the Madhyam stage of devotional service, then we start seeing much more intersection, much more overlap, where much of one's activities, even those activities which have to do with maintaining oneself, one's family, one's responsibility, they are also connected with Krishna consciousness. They're done in the spirit of devotion. And so as one becomes even more advanced, becomes larger and larger, till finally when one comes to the Uttama Adhikari stage, the stage of pure devotional service, there's this complete overlap between all of one's activities and one's devotional service are really one and the same. Now, we don't see that a lot, but we are very, very fortunate that we had the amazing ability, or the opportunity, I should say, to see Srila Prabhupada. And in Srila Prabhupada's life, we saw that. We saw the complete overlap, you know, where every single activity was for Krishna, thinking about Krishna. This is Krishna consciousness. So we do see that example as possible, because we have the acharyas, we have the pure devotees who show us how to really see Krishna everywhere and always. That was one of those little books, remember? We had seeing Krishna everywhere. I thought it was very interesting. And it was taken from some lectures where Srila Prabhupada would say that, you know, if one, you know, is drinking water, then just drink the water, you know. You think, oh, that is the pure taste of Krishna, right? Now, I do that about once a year when I think to use that for demonstration in class. Usually I'm just thirsty and I drink water, you know, because I'm not very advanced in Krishna consciousness. Now, if I were advanced in Krishna consciousness, I would be seeing everything like that. That, yes, this is Krishna. Krishna is here. I walk outside and I see the sun coming up, and I see, this is Krishna. The sun and the moon are Krishna's eyes. Or, you know, and of course, Bhagavad Gita gives us many, many examples. You know, those chapters like the 10th chapter, where all of these examples are given of how we begin to see Krishna everywhere. So that's kind of our beginning. When our consciousness changes to start thinking that way. I was just thinking this morning about this, that, you know, we could go to the beach. We all like to go to the beach. I think they're going to go to the beach this Saturday in Jacksonville. Right? Well, they are. It's the opening. It's the opening Jacksonville Beach. So, you know, you can go and you can take your family and you can go and have a good time at the beach and take some lunch and, you know, have fun. Or you can go to the beach and you can think all of these things, you know. Did you ever think about at the beach that all the waters of the ocean, you know, all the ocean was touched by Lord Ramachandra, other incarnations as well, and so that same water in all the oceans is really connected, and so, you know, it's actually a place of a holy place, isn't it? You know, where the water touches the land is like a place of pilgrimage everywhere, because Krishna's lotus feet, Ramachandra's lotus feet touch that water. You know, I mean, just in so many ways, we can start to train our consciousness to think of Krishna everywhere. You know, and then it's a very, very different experience. You know, it's not that, you know, every moment of our life, particularly those who are householders, every moment of our life, we're out on book distribution or Harinam or preaching constantly. But whatever we do, even our so-called more mundane activities in life, you know, we can start to think of Krishna, start to see the relationship and the connections with Krishna. So for a devotee, we don't turn Krishna consciousness on or off. You know, now I'm coming to the temple, I'm sitting here, and now I'm Krishna conscious, I walk out the door and, you know, and then click, you know. It's like onto my other concentric circles going over here. You know, we try to train ourselves and train our consciousness to connect and to make all of our activities, all of our thoughts, all of our relationships, all of our service in relationship with Krishna. It doesn't come immediately. And, you know, sometimes certain times of our life are more conducive than others. But we should be striving to see that. More and more, how am I closing that gap between the material consciousness and the spiritual consciousness, material activities and spiritual activities? And, of course, we do that in very, very simple ways by the nine process of devotional service, beginning with hearing and chanting, following the orders of the spiritual master, following the principles, and sadhusanga, associating with devotees. One of the best ways of closing that gap between our material consciousness and spiritual consciousness is association with devotees. Good association with devotees. Devotees who are going to help us to remember Krishna. And that's one of the definitions of a devotee, isn't it? The devotee is one upon seeing him, that one remembers Krishna or wants to chant Hare Krishna. So it's good, you know, we want to have advanced association or at least association that helps us to remember Krishna. And this is why we associate together, and that we get strength and support from one another, and we help one another to remember that goal and keep that very prominent. Because as marginal living entities, Tathashta Shakti, it's very easy for us to become covered over again. And we see that sometimes devotees, you know, that those two circles start drifting apart again. And, you know, in Krishna consciousness, it can become a very, very separated thing. It's something one just occasionally does. You know, comes to temple Janmashtami or something. And, you know, and that's not to say that, I mean, a person could, of course, be anywhere in any circumstance and be fully absorbed in thinking of Krishna and serving Krishna. You know, but we know that if we stay in association of Krishna, Krishna's devotees, Krishna's temple, the wonderful, the beautiful deities that inspire us, you know, we're more likely to keep in that frame of mind of seeing Krishna everywhere, thinking about him, and less becoming attracted to the material world. Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. About a few minutes. Are there any questions, comments, thoughts? Yes, Yamaraj?
I wanted to know, like, spiritual master, he leads the planet, and just say like the disciple, the spiritual master has to deliver all of his disciples. Mm-hmm. So the so I guess in the, I was sort of perplexed about this. So like the spiritual master, he's in the spiritual world, and so does he know? Because in the spiritual world, I guess they know past, present, and future.
Mm-hmm.
So would he be able to know already, even before the disciple left the material world, if he was going back to?
Would the spiritual master, even after he's left the planet, know whether the disciple would go back to Godhead at the end of his lifetime? I'm not sure. The spiritual master knows what as much as Krishna wants him to know. The spiritual master is not super soul. He's a jiva. You know, so in other words, yes, knows past, present, and future, but no living entity is, you know, totally omniscient, omnipresent, you know, everything, you know. But to the degree whatever Krishna reveals to a pure devotee, of course they can know. And they can, and in fact, you know, Srila Prabhupada demonstrated many times, you know, where he had understanding of the future, and you can, you know, hear so many pastimes that show that he was sometimes, you know, had this ability, you know. But it's not that it's how to put this. We don't want to overly attribute qualities to even the guru or even the pure devotee, which are beyond the qualities of the jiva. If you know what I'm saying. In other words, you know, we don't always know how much the spiritual master is going to know about everything. You know, as I said, they're not the super soul. You know, but on the other hand, I don't know if the question is more about how does the spiritual master deliver the disciple after their departure. I don't know, maybe you're kind of getting more towards that. And, of course, we know that once that connection, once that link is there with the civic succession going all the way back to Krishna, you know, then that relationship is secure. You know, that relationship is guaranteed. Srila Prabhupada said sometimes that he would come back to deliver us, to deliver those of us who didn't make it this lifetime. Exactly how that's done, I think we don't want to overly speculate. Because does the spiritual master literally come back, have to take birth in this material world, life after life after life, for all of those disciples who don't make it, you know, and have to keep taking more of our lives? I'm not sure. I don't know if Srila Prabhupada gave us that kind of detail. But I'll take this again, and I'll go back to Pran Govinda.
Srila Prabhupada Thakur had that incident where he was chasing after prostitutes,
yeah.
The spiritual master,
yeah.
Spoke through the prostitutes. That's one of the ways
that you can. Yeah, and don't make your spiritual master do that, right? I mean, if aggression is there, you know, so be very careful. All right, okay. From Govinda?
In this case, prostitute was not guru, but he used Prabhupada gave a very, if you look at the sentence, because I was thinking about it, Prabhupada said, Krishna appears, guru appears in that form, but one disciple should not take advantage of it.
Yeah.
That or should not. But in Purana, there is a one verse quoted by Matsya Purma Vihanga, and that spiritual master, after departs, the reason is the intensity for disciple to come closer has to rise.
Mm-hmm.
So he does manifest in three ways. And one way is like a fish, let the baby fish goes in the front, and from the far, mother fish watches.
Mm.
So Guru is always there. Even in Tathya Kampa, it says that Guru is even create a scenery for the disciple to come back. So if the disciple is fully taking shelter of Guru or Prabhupada, then he will come back. So everything we see even after Guru depart, that it is the mercy of Prabhupada or Guru to ignite mind. And the other one is the bird, and the other one is turtle. The turtle is there in the spiritual world, or under the water you can say, but the baby is in the egg form under the sand. But when the sand, when they hatch, how they know that the mother is there? He said there is an eternal bond, that's called Diksha. Diksha means beginning of immortality. So when the disciple leaves the world, they go that place where Guru is.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. He will be waiting.
What was the bird?
Bird is that when the baby hatches, the eggs hatches, then the bird automatically flies and the mother stays there. But this is alive, but after Guru depart,
Okay.
So three-way Guru always
That's very interesting. And that's kind of been my understanding. In other words, the Guru will guide us back to God, and it may be in different ways. You know, maybe literally coming and taking birth, or maybe, you know, from giving us spiritual inspiration or guiding in other ways to bring us back. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting point. Because even back in the 70s, in ISKCON, it was like Prabhupada was personally there, holding everybody's hand, guiding them, but his organizational skills, through his sincerity, through his books, and arrangements were made. So, I guess I'm speculating, but you could extrapolate on how a variety of ranges,
right.
It's from the Guru's desire to save the disciples.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. Many of us didn't have a lot of contact with Srila Prabhupada even during his manifest presence, but we felt the sort of his energy, his manifestation through his disciples, his temples, his books, of course. You know, and so that connection was there, not necessarily dependent upon, you know, physical proximity. Okay. Yes, Kupishan. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the other one I was thinking. But Chaitanya was went into the ocean. Right. Yeah, it's nice. Right. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Oh, sorry. One more? We can get one more question real quick.
Clarify a little more, because in the same line of thought, saying that the spiritual master, you know, takes the responsibility to save the disciple all the way through, because someone say that maybe now I accept another Diksha Guru because that's what my spiritual master is sending for me in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody can say that too.
Yeah. Even if the spiritual master left or something, you mean, or?
Yeah, say that somebody takes Diksha from one spiritual master. And then that person, that spiritual master eats his body, and then he decides, 10 years later that he wants to accept Diksha from another guru, with a line of thought that, this is my original guru giving me this instruction.
Yes, that's a good way to think about it. Yeah. Okay, I guess we'll have one more.
I was just wondering, wouldn't that be more that one would take a Shiksha guru rather than a Diksha guru?
Well, I wasn't quite clear there. If one had, if one was initiated by a spiritual master in good standing, then it would really be more Shiksha. Now, unless you're thinking, talking about the situation where a spiritual master might fall down and one might take reinitiation if one was so inclined. You know, it's different circumstances. Yeah, but you know, it's really, when you think about it, it's the tremendous power of the Guru Parampara that's at work. You know, that when that connection is there, I mean, you not only have the mercy of your current guru, but the, you know, the all the spiritual masters on back, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know, we have a very powerful line, you know, that's giving shelter in so many ways, and when that connection is made, you know, the spiritual energy can manifest in so many ways, inconceivable ways. And but for the sincere disciple, the one thing I become convinced of is there's not any tricks in Krishna consciousness. You're not going to do something kind of a little bit wrong and then, oh, you missed the boat and, you know, and you're out of luck. No, it's not like that. Krishna's making arrangements for all of us to come back home, back to Godhead. Jai. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.